So, good evening. This is the eighth week of this nine-week course I've been teaching. And tonight we're going to talk about the seven factors of awakening. It's another piece of what's called the fourth foundation of mindfulness. So it's a Dhamma. It's a way of, in this case, it's a way of looking at what we experience as we establish mindfulness and then progressively go deeper and deeper into the practice. I want to read a little bit of the sutta. This is quite a long description, but I'll read a little bit of it. So this is the actual instructions. If the mindfulness awakening factor is present in him, he knows there is the mindfulness awakening factor in me. If the mindfulness awakening factor is not present in him, he knows there is no mindfulness awakening factor in me. She knows how the unarisen mindfulness factor can arise and how the arisen mindfulness awakening factor can be perfected by development. And then he just goes on in exactly the same wording for the other six factors, which are investigation, energy, pithi, which is a difficult translation. Often you see it translated as rapture, but also it might be translated as joyful interest, then calm, concentration, and equanimity. So those are the seven factors. And this is usually seen as a sequential process. One of the other interesting things, I think, is that what we're talking about here, the seven factors of awakening, is one of the sort of the central teachings the Buddha has on the progression of the practice once things are going well. Once we've established mindfulness, once mindfulness, the mental formation of mindfulness has arisen, and then things move on from there. The other thing is, in various translations of the Satipatthana Sutta, because this, you know, it was originally in Pali, then it got translated into Sanskrit and Tibetan and Chinese and Japanese and some other East Asian languages. It's got all these different translations. Different translations leave out certain things, different, especially in the fourth foundation. They leave out pieces of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. But the two sections that are always there are the kalesas, you know, the obstructions to practice, and the seven factors of awakening. Those are the two that are always there, no matter whose translation in what language. Those are the ones that have always been maintained, which points to something about the importance of this teaching, I guess, and the teaching on the kalesas. The other interesting thing in relation to that is that the seven factors of awakening and are seen as direct antidotes to the kalesas. So certain pieces of the seven factors of awakening will, and I'll mention it as we go through, are directly an antidote to a particular kalesa. So it seems like it might be useful to know this, right? There's another thing I think that's really interesting. And you notice what he says here. He says we have to know four things, right? We have to know if mindfulness is present, if it's not present. He knows how the unarisen mindfulness factor can arise, how this mindfulness arises, and knows how to maintain it if it has arisen. This is an expression in a slightly different form of the teachings on mindful effort. Effort has these four phases, right? So the first phase is, you know, if something has arisen that's distracting you, then you need to, it takes effort to know that. This is like, know how it arises, right? Then it's also, the second layer of wholesome effort is, if something is there that shouldn't be there, like you're not only distracted but caught in an unwholesome mind state, do what you can to shift that, which is knowing if it's not there. Oh, no, if mindfulness isn't there, then what is? Well, guess what? Okay, so this is like a positive statement, right? Then he says, no, if it is there. Well, this is like, know that a wholesome mind state is there. Third layer of right effort. Know if wholesome mind state is present. And the fourth is, if something has arisen that's wholesome, do what you can to maintain it, which is know how it's maintained. So here's the Buddha taking this very basic teaching, you know, right out of the Eightfold Path, and stating it in different language, in a different sequence, in a sense, but it's the same idea. We have to be aware. The other interesting thing is that mindfulness itself is the first of the seven factors of awakening. So all the things we're doing to practice are all leading to the wholesome mind state of mindfulness arising. So it's like I've said this before, we're not practicing mindfulness so much as practicing creating the causes and conditions such that mindfulness might actually arise. And then if it does arise, we should know it. We should see, that this is what mindfulness is. We actually experience it and know it for what it is. So how do we know? And this is a tricky question in some ways. First of all, the actual practice of mindfulness, there's lots of different techniques. You know, what I'm teaching is one formal way using noting practice. It's taught in many other ways. I'm saying that only to make sure you understand that what I'm teaching is only one view that I've practiced myself and how I've been taught and how I've been practicing for the last 22 years in this form of practice. And so mindfulness is a mental factor, it's a mental state that arises. Which of course means, just like all things that arise, it'll be there for a while and then it'll be gone. So we have to be aware of that too. It's like, oh well, now I've got mindfulness arisen, I'm done. No, no. Mindfulness is the beginning of these seven factors, right? That's also important. And mindfulness is the base, the ground from which the other six factors arise. They come as a result of mindfulness being there. Because this is a sequential process. So when we say mindfulness, how do we know mindfulness is there? And there are four what are called qualities of mindfulness that might be useful in terms of being able to note that it's actually there. And first of these is not forgetting. Staying firmly with your object, whatever your object of mindfulness is, you stay very firmly and steadily with it. Not wandering. In some commentaries, they say the mind is like a post set firmly in the ground. So, and the mind is sort of like tethered to that post. So it can sort of wander a little bit away, but it can't get very far because it's tethered, right? So it keeps coming back and staying close to the post, which is deeply grounded and solid. It's an image, right? It's also sometimes mindfulness thought of as presence, not looking away. Sometimes in our practice, especially when the unpleasant has arisen, is we go, oh, I don't want to look at that. You want to push it away. Aversion has arisen. Aversion is a direct pushing away of mindfulness. We have to be aware that when aversion arises, what we're doing is saying, no, there's no way I'm going to be mindful of that. It's like too icky or too whatever. So we have to be very careful about not trying to keep our distance from things. When things arise, we just have to be with them. Another translation of sati, the word that usually is translated as mindfulness, is remembering. And remembering is just basically, we keep remembering, as we sit here doing our formal practice, the mind starts to wander, and then remember, oh, no, I'm doing my practice, and we remember and go back to our object of meditation. Just constantly remembering and starting again. And also, mindfulness is always associated with, very directly, with the ideas of wisdom. Particularly, the wisdom is simple. Isn't, we think wisdom is some big deal, but it actually, when wisdom is present, there's a simplicity, a purity to wisdom that becomes obvious. And this is like, the phrase that I often use when I'm teaching, saying, just sit and know you're sitting. But, so it's not a big deal. Don't we try to make some big production out of practice, right? And if we can just let the wisdom arise, mindfulness arises and wisdom is there. Wisdom being that mental factor that allows us to see things clearly, which is another description of mindfulness sometimes. Also, not making up stories about what you're experiencing, which we often do. Something arises, and then we launch into some amazing story about how wonderful it is. Oh my God, I've reached that thing just like it said in the book. Or, oh my God, this is so horrible. How am I stuck here again? But we're still telling ourselves stories. Just be with what's there. That's the idea behind mindfulness. And so, the way to recognize mindfulness is, can you see it as this simple, pure space of mind that arises due to whatever skillful means you're using to create causes and conditions for its arising in the first place? And then once mindfulness is there, then the next thing that typically comes, and these are things that we can cultivate, right? I'm not saying they all appear magically. It's like once mindfulness is there, then what's called Dhammavacaya, which is usually translated as investigation, is the next of the seven factors. We have to be careful because the English word investigation has this sort of implication of figuring things out or thinking about it or something like that. And that's not what it means here, but there's no other English word that corresponds nicely to Dhammavacaya. And this is that wisdom factor that I was talking about a minute ago. And basically, what we're investigating is not the content of what's arising, but the process that underlies everything that's arising. We're starting to see that no matter what, if we can be mindful of it, no matter what it is, whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, who knows, there's just stuff that's arising. If we see it as just stuff, and then the mind starts to see this process of things arising, there for a while, then they're gone. And then something else arises, is there for a while, and all that's what's all that's ever going on. We see underneath the incredible variety of what's arising, that it's all really just this pattern of things arising, being there, and disappearing. In other words, we're starting to experience the fact that things are impermanent. We actually see the impermanence of everything without exception. And that leads us to an understanding of unsatisfactoriness. Dukkha, the fact that, well, if everything is arising and then going away, then there's nothing that we can hold on to that brings us happiness, because it's all going to change. It's guaranteed to change without exception. And then that then leads over time to this understanding of not self, because not only is everything changing all the time, but if we look really closely, we don't see any separate self there. It's just stuff arising and being there and going. And we talked about that a lot last week when we talked about, the five aggregates of clinging. But it becomes something we experience as opposed to something we theoretically understand. So we're not thinking about it anymore. We're actually experiencing it and seeing it very clearly. So investigation is also, in a sense, and this is a different view of it from what I've been giving up till now, is another word is discrimination, where it leads to the ability to distinguish between what's wholesome and what isn't. This is this idea of if I'm functioning at the level of investigating what's arising, something arises and I can see and experience the wholesomeness or unwholesomeness of it and go, oh, I should lean towards the wholesome and away from the unwholesome. So we start to steer our practice a bit more with Dhamma Vachaya. This is also considered an antidote to doubt. Doubt is very unwholesome. We get caught in, and we start to see when we're caught in doubt, oh, this is just this unwholesome mind state of doubting everything and not, just trying to I have to figure everything out. And, doubt is always has this figuring out vibe to it. And we start going, no, I can just see that this is just the way things are. This is the way things are. And that often extinguishes the doubt. Then we come to the third of these. So once mindfulness is established and investigation is established, then what comes next is we start to go, oh, now I have to understand how much energy to put into this. So the third factor is energy or virya. Sometimes translated as effort, not energy. And this is the realization, no one can do this for me. No one can lead me towards enlightenment. I have to do that myself. And that means I have to actually put energy into this practice. I have to put effort into the practice without having any magic formulas or anybody sort of doing anything. I'm just going to do it myself because that's the only way to do it. Not that being in Sangha doesn't help, but in the end, it's up to me. And other translations of this virya, by the way, are strength and courage. At this point, it's like, oh, this is hard. This is difficult. This takes a lot of work. That takes courage and strength to actually continue, to actually keep going, as opposed to going, well, that was nice, but now let's go watch some TV or whatever else we use to distract ourselves, right? The tricky part with virya, with energy, is we have to keep it in balance. Too little, and we sort of, just doze off. Too much, and we get tense. And somewhere in the middle, what the Buddha called the middle path. It's like finding just the right balance of, yeah, I need to put a bit more energy into this, but I don't want to overdo it and sort of get myself wound up. Too much energy often has embedded in it expectation. If I just keep grinding away, something amazing is going to happen, which doesn't really work at all. In fact, it just gets in the way. It's also what makes us want to practice more, what inspires us, is often something that Joseph Goldstein calls spiritual urgency. So I want to share you this section from Joseph's book, Mindfulness. And he's talking about what causes this energy to arise in some sense. The proximate cause of the arising of virya as a factor of enlightenment, so proximate means immediately before, is the feeling of spiritual urgency. When the Buddha talked of attending to these awakening factors as a matter of vital concern and not simply as something to do in our off hours. There are some powerful reflections that remind us of this urgency. We can reflect on the preciousness of our present circumstances. Whether we think of it in the context of many lives or just in this life, we can see and appreciate how rare it is for all the conditions to come together in order for us to hear the Dhamma. And even more so, for us to have the interest, motivation, and opportunity to practice. How lucky we are. How amazingly fortunate we are that we're doing this together right now. We don't even, it's like, we can't just accept, well, lucky me, that's what I'm doing now. And also, how lucky that I'll be able to do this tomorrow, hopefully. Because things change so quickly, right? We often think that conditions will always be favorable. But any look at the world around us reveals the truth of uncertainty, from war and violence to natural disasters to our own aging bodies. Wise reflection on the uncertainty of conditions heightens the appreciation of our present circumstances. Reflecting on death is another powerful reminder to use it, the times of our lives in a way that benefits ourselves and others. We don't know when that's going to happen. We don't really have a clue how much longer we have in this body. Which don't. No one does. And so, knowing that, it's like, can you practice every day? Like, this might be your last day of practice. Who knows? Before I came to this practice, I practiced with a Swami named Swami Vishnu Devananda, and he had this thing he'd do where he would, he was trying to encourage us to practice more seriously. And it was a question he'd ask. And if you knew the answer, you weren't allowed to say the answer out loud because those new people, because there was always new people. He said, what's the difference between yesterday and today? And people would say things like, oh, Swamiji, you know, today is Wednesday and tomorrow's Thursday, you know, or, you know, it was raining yesterday and today it's sunny, you know, and all kinds of different things, you know. Different answers. Yesterday I was in Montreal, but now I'm here, you know. And what's the difference between yesterday and today? And his answer, eventually say, no, no, no. The difference between yesterday and today is today you're one day closer to death. At which point, most of us would go, ugh, some of you are so depressing. Because, you know, we were like young, this is like in my 30s and 40s, right? We were always sort of young and healthy and busy, and who wanted to think about death? But this is like, you know, the teachings on the five remembrances. If you're curious about it, something to look into, because it really, the five remembrances, you know, talking about the fact that it's the nature of this body to age, the nature of the body to sick, it's the nature of this body to pass away, the nature of everything we have, nothing, we can't take anything with us. You know, it's like we have to remember these things all the time because it encourages us to practice. So that's, I just think it's interesting that we think of things in that way. Virya, by the way, is an antidote to sloth and torpor. You know, that lack of energy, sort of fuzzy, vague mind that we happen to find sometimes. Virya is the antidote to that. Then we come to the fourth of these factors, which is pity. And as I said, pity is often translated as rapture, which I never liked. It's because it sort of has that sort of holy roller Christian evangelical vibe to it, like we're all going to go into the raptures. Partly my upbringing but causes me to think that way, I suppose. Another translation I think which is much better is, you know, joy. Really interested, joyful practice. You know, we need to enjoy the practice. It's really important that we develop an intense interest in it. Become deeply focused on it. And this pity arises out of the intensity of the first three factors. So mindfulness is present, investigation is present, we're putting in energy, then pity arises. And this pitti is a place where we often get stuck at this point. Because pitti can be quite pleasurable. It has lots of really pleasurable physical manifestations and some quite pleasurable mental manifestations as well, visions and things. And we get caught by the pleasantness of it. And then if we're not careful, then we end up just practicing to have those pleasant mind states again and again and again. And we get stuck sort of halfway up this process. We've learned to be very, have the mind quite focused and concentrated. We become mindful, and then we get into these blissful states. And it's like, this is what I wanted all along. This is where I thought we should be going. And yes, they're interesting, and yes, they encourage us to practice more. But they're not the end in any way. And we end up turning this practice into a way to get high, to fulfill our desire for that sweet feeling. And think, oh, I've really got it all figured out now. And it's not. This is, and the other thing with this joy, and we have to understand this is joy that arises purely from at the mental level. There's no, often we think of joy as I got some great thing. Well, it's not getting anything here. You're just feeling joyful. Feeling, wow, this is so interesting, without getting distracted by how beautiful and interesting it is. This is an antidote to both desire and aversion, if we can find the balance. If not, we get caught in. The other thing of pity is sometimes it can be quite disturbing, the physical sensations that arise, and kind of scary even. And so we have to be aware of that, because then we get averse to those things. Oh, I don't want that, which is the opposite thing that happens. In both cases, we just go, oh, isn't that interesting? My body's shaking and it feels like I'm going to fall over. That's okay, which is one thing that happens sometimes, as opposed to, oh, isn't it interesting? I feel like I'm sort of levitated off the floor, which also happens. And we get caught in both wanting or avoiding both of those things. This is just what happens, the natural occurrences that arise in the body. Then, and what I think is really interesting, so all these things seem to be sort of more and more energetic, right? And then, what comes after rapture and pitti? Pasadi, tranquility. This, an emotional calmness, steadiness. It's like, it doesn't matter what's arising, it doesn't matter what's going on at the level of, experience. It's like, it's all okay. There's this calm, steady, still mental state that arises that, once again, is quite pleasant. So once again, we can get stuck here if we're not careful. But it's a great antidote to restlessness and worry. And often, with the steadiness of mind, the body becomes very, very still. And the breath, it's like if you're noting breath, it's like, where's my breath now? It's like the breath almost like becomes so still and so simple that it's hard to see. It's like even the breath becomes still. It's still there. If we weren't breathing, that would be the end, right? So the breath is still there, but it becomes extremely subtle, and the body becomes very, very still. This is why stillness of body is so strongly emphasized in this practice, by the way, because stillness of body leads to stillness of mind. These are tightly interrelated things. And this is considered an antidote to restlessness and worry. I mean, why would you worry? Why would you be restless if the mind is crystal clear and perfectly still, and the body is perfectly still, to the point where at times your body, not quite the word, I want to use the word disappear, but that's not good. It's like you have less and less sensation of the body itself. That's part of what can also arise at this point, where the body is way in the background, I guess the only way I can describe it, where bodily sensation is like, yeah, it's there, but it's very, very subtle, partly due to the stillness. And then after that, so now we're getting into the next one, which is samadhi. Samadhi in Pali, as opposed to Sanskrit, so I want to make that clear. In Sanskrit, samadhi means something different. But in Pali, samadhi means concentration, just simply that. You know, a mind that is steady and one-pointed. Whether it's on a particular object or on that, as we do in mindfulness practice, this changing object that we just can flow from one object to the next based on what's arising in that moment. But it's focused, steady, clear concentration. Another thing, and this is just like a side note, and you see this all through the sutta, you know, where the Buddha is talking about concentration in various forms, and in all cases, every time I've come across this in the sutta, he says it, says very clearly, oh, by the way, concentration is based on sila, on wholesomeness, on leading a wholesome life. If you're not leading a wholesome life, like in the day-to-day world, it's pretty hard for the mind to become concentrated because you're always worried about stuff. Oh my God, what if someone finds out about that? Or, oh, I shouldn't have done that, and, you know, caught up in all that emotional turmoil. And it's just a little note that I wanted to put in here more than anything. And then comes upekkha, which usually you see translated as equanimity. It's an evenness of mind. So not only is the mind concentrated, not only are things very still, not only is mindfulness there, investigation is still there, energy is still there, pitti is still there, though perhaps a little more subtly so. Calmness is there, concentration is there, then upekkha arises, equanimity, and which is basically an evenness of mind. It's not thrown by whatever extreme might happen to arise, it doesn't affect the mind. It's like, it's just like, oh, that, okay, that's kind of, that's not pleasant, but who cares? Or, and it's not that you don't care, so it doesn't affect you. It's the only way I can describe it. And it's sort of like the mental endpoint of this practice. Everything is leading to this place where equanimity arises. In other lists, you'll see equanimity being there as well. In other teachings of the Buddha, equanimity is always where we want to end, where we end up. And it's also so there's things like the four Brahma Viharas. They all lead, the first three lead to equanimity, and equanimity balances the other three. The teaching called the ten paramis, the ten perfections of the heart, the very last of the ten paramis, which is another one of these lists, is equanimity. So we keep coming to this place. This is where we're moving towards. And basically, the thing we need to understand, this is, I'm sort of coming back to this in a way, is that these seven factors are successive. One leads to the next. They're also things we can clearly experience and note. You can see very clearly when they arise and you experience them. It's like you have these moments where you go, oh, That's what he was talking about. You know, you start to see the process going very clearly from one thing to the next. And the thing with equanimity is it's just, I mean, it's extremely pleasant, but it's also, the pleasantness doesn't even distract you. And it's not, it's like you just, it's a crispness and stillness and focused mind that isn't affected by whatever's arising. It doesn't get pushed or pulled in any direction. It just stays clearly there. And that these things, equanimity arises because one thing leads to another, essentially. This is, I want to share a little bit. This is from Satipatthana, which is the Anilaya's book on the Satipatthana Sutta. And he's talking about this idea of them being successive. Practically applied, the whole set of the seven awakening factors can be understood to describe the process and progress of Satipatthana practice to this level of deep equanimity. On the basis of well-established mindfulness, one investigates the nature of subjective reality. Once a sustained investigation gains momentum, then energy is applied, and with growing insight, the object of contemplation becomes clear, and the meditator feels inspired, and there's joy arises, to continue with the practice. If at this point the danger of getting carried away by elation and agitation can be avoided, right, it's that pity energy, continued contemplation leads to a state of calmness, when the mind stays effortlessly with its meditation object, without succumbing to distraction, and its concentration has risen. This, with maturing insight, this process culminates in a state of firm equanimity and detachment. It is at this point, when the inspired momentum of mindful investigation takes place against the background of tranquil composure, that the mental equipoise needed for a breakthrough to awakening comes about. In other words, that once the seven factors are all functioning and you're aware, then the possibility of awakening becomes stronger. And remember, awakening might be like 3 seconds of awakening at first, or it might be a little bit, might last for a minute, and then it goes away because it's like everything else, they arise and they pass away. But constantly deepening the practice and coming back to equanimity over and over makes the whole process of awakening more likely and more solid. At this level of practice, a deep sense of complete letting go prevails. In other words, we're not clinging to anything, you know, which is how awakening is often described. You know, not clinging to anything is often, you'll see that those actual words in a lot of the descriptions. You know, of awakening. Not clinging to anything is a way of describing being awake. I also want to share one other thing from Joseph here. He's talking about equanimity here. Equanimity is one of these beautiful universals. Is the mental factor called neutrality of mind. Bhikkhu Bodhi said the Pali term could literally be translated there in the middleness. Although this is an awkward construction in English, it does convey the balancing power of equanimity. Its characteristics is evenness, and when it is highly developed, it manifests as unshakable balance of mind. It serves to prevent deficiency or excess in the other mental factors. And then it goes on. The first way we experience the cool, restful quality of equanimity is in the peace and balance it brings to our daily lives. Oh, wait, this actually applies to our life. This is important to remember. Right? Each of us is touched by what are called the eight worldly vicissitudes. These are the endlessly changing conditions of gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, and pleasure and pain. When equanimity is developed, we ride these waves with balance and ease. Without it, we're tossed about by the waves, often crashing into the changing circumstances of our lives. So the more often we experience equanimity in our meditation practice, in our formal practice, it builds up a reservoir of this steadiness that in our day-to-day lives out in the world of relative reality, it tends to make us unshakable up there in our daily lives. Which seems like probably the most important thing. If we can be unshakable out there in our daily lives, then we affect all those around us. People who are not calm, if they experience someone who's being very calm and still and focused and not spacing out, but actually being right there, it changes everything around them, changes people, changes everything. And that's an equally important aspect of this practice. I guess what I'm trying to get at is I don't think this practice is just about achieving equanimity. It's about then taking that energy out into the world, which can actually affect things. So, don't make this a big project, as I've said with some of the other of these dhammas, these things in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. Don't I have to sit for the next 30 minutes and see these seven factors arising. Who knows? They may. But remember that the practice is we're just starting and we're getting our mind focused and still and practicing whatever form of practice we have that creates the causes and conditions such that mindfulness arises. Then we have to be aware that mindfulness has arisen. Remember, that was one of the four conditions. And then once we're aware that mindfulness has arisen and we can maintain it, then these other things sort of naturally come. And then if you're in that state of calm mindfulness, you can consciously choose. Well, let's investigate the nature of the mind. Dhamma Vachaya, investigations. And you start to see this, things arise that there for a while and then. These are all things you can practice and choose to move towards once you've established mindfulness itself. And that's also important, that we can't sort of think this is a totally passive process. This is an active, conscious choice we're making to practice the seven factors, one leading to the next. Then we see that the next one's there, and we go, oh, this is interesting. Now let's put more energy into the practice. And then, oh, look, this is now pithy's arisen. Oh, wait, now I've got past that, the energetic energy of pithy, and this calm stillness is there instead. And I can see how clear and crisp the mind and concentration are. We start to see these things happening as part of the practice. And it takes time. Don't think, if I don't do it in the next half hour, that's it. I'm not going to bother with this stuff anymore. This is something that, this is the life of this practice, is going this direction. That's what it's about, in a sense. So, what I'd like to suggest is we can sit for 20, 25 minutes. And then we'll have a little bit of time at the end for questions and comments and thoughts. What I'd like to do right now is remind people who are listening to this recording that in a minute or so I'm going to stop talking. There'll be a period of of recording with nothing on it, and at that point you should shut off your recording, sit for as long as you want to sit, then turn the recording back on, and then maybe there'll be a little bit of more things afterwards. So let's just settle in, make sure you're comfortable, make sure your body is erect and alert. Set the intention to very consciously and energetically work with whatever the form of the practice you're working with, to create the causes and conditions so that the first factor arises, mindfulness, and then see what happens from there. So I have one other thing to share, and then I want to leave time for you folks to share things or ask questions. In my experience of practice, the seven factors of awakening typically start to become clearer when we're practicing in Sangha. Typically over longer periods of time, but it could be just sitting here together tonight. Sangha is the support that is underneath all of this. You know, it's really difficult to do this, to do this practice on your own. Even though we all practice on our own because we're all, you know, in our own little worlds in a sense. But at the same time, it's Sangha that supports this practice and makes it possible to go deeper into the practice. So don't neglect being connected to Sangha. It's a really important part of what we do here. Other than that, I have nothing else other to say. I have a bit of poetry to read, so I want to just sort of open the floor and see if anybody has any questions or has anything they'd like to share, as I do every week. So just small in the group, you can just turn on your mic and go ahead and say what you need to say, if anything. Don't think for one second that this is like, well, that's nice for those people who are really advanced, but I'm not an advanced practitioner, so this doesn't mean anything to me. This is all something we can all experience without question. I believe that. Karen, you got your mic on.
Yeah, one of the things that actually came to me just last night, I still practice with my group in Orlando, and we meet on Wednesday night, and I had just shared that we talked about doubt, skeptical doubt, because we're going through the hindrances one at a time, and I had just shared that I had been experiencing a lot of restlessness and worry, which I understand is connected with doubt. And so at any event, the teacher said that the antidote was to go back to the breath, to go back to the breath. And so what I realize is that I need to spend more time in the practice and not, and I will have periods where I'll spend more time in the practice, and then I get into the conceptual readings, trying to understand it, which is helpful. But I think what I'm learning is that it is more about your own experience. And so the only way you can experience it is to practice.
Yeah, it's a very direct, straight line relationship. The more you practice, the more you understand, not on an intellectual level, but on an experiential level, which is really, intellectual understanding is really useful. And it's sort of our Western mind way of thinking how we have to do everything, got to figure it all out. But a lot of it has to do just with putting in the hours and really diligently practicing for longer and longer periods of time. And that's and the other thing about doubt, by the way, it's actually another great antidote to doubt is to go back to your original intention, to think about why am I doing this in the first place? And reconnecting and really thinking about your intention for practice, often just reconnecting to the intention removes the doubt. Oh, I can see why I'm doing this based on my intention, and that makes sense. So then, and so then the doubt dissipates. It's the other classic antidote to doubt.
Okay. The only other thing I wanted to mention is I think what I understand the investigation process to be from listening tonight is it's more about noticing the changes in the mind. It's not about going into, well, why am I doing this and investigating what happened when I was five and blah, blah, blah.
It has nothing to do with figuring things out. Yes.
Okay. It's more about the impermanence of
Yeah, like
things.
seeing the underlying patterns of all experience would be a way of describing it.
Rising and the passing,
Yeah,
rising
yeah.
and the passing. Okay. Because that was one that I used to ask the question, well, what are we investigating? I never got a clear answer. And a lot of these people did want to investigate, past history of their life, which is not what I was interested in
Yeah.
at the times. And so thank you. I appreciate it. I think I understand a little bit better about the investigation process.
Good, good. I've done my job today. I'm happy.
Thank you.
Anyone else have anything they'd like to share or talk about or ask questions about? So let's finish with a little bit of poetry. And I mentioned this, how important Sangha is. And I understand this more and more as I go along in my own life of practice, that being connected to other people, associating with other people who are practicing, is really an important way to keep us practicing. We see other people practicing and we experience their practice. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. The poem is called Sangha. Teach me what I cannot learn alone. Let us share what we know and what we cannot fathom. Speak to me of mysteries and let us never lie to one another. May our fierce and tender longing fuel the fire in our souls. When we stand side by side, let us dare to focus our desire on the truth. May we be reminders, each for the other, that the path of transformation passes through the flames. To take one step is courageous. Stay on the path day after day, choosing the unknown and facing yet another fear, that is nothing short of grace. I think that describes exactly what Karen and I were just talking about in some ways. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.